Chris, thank you so much for joining me today on Misunderstood.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So I had a guy on, The Watch King NYC, a couple months ago.
Right.
And, you know, everyone kind of went bananas over everything that he was talking about. So I figured I had to have someone like you come on who has a completely different background and insight maybe to these things, because I wanted to hear your perspective. But before we get into that, I really want to hear about you because you're a fascinating dude. So can we talk about like your childhood and where you came from and how you even got into this?
No, absolutely. Born and raised in New York City, grew up in Manhattan, went to school in Manhattan.
Where'd you go to school?
Went to school at St. Francis Xavier on 16th Street.
Okay.
Yeah, 16th Street and 6th Avenue. So I kind of grew up running around the village and all of that. So
right.
real New Yorker.
Amazing. I went to Nightingale.
Bam. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
We had a cousin. I've never, usually the diamond and jewelry industry, as most people know, they're usually family-owned businesses. And again, went to a Jesuit military high school. A lot of my friends went to the Ivy Leagues or Annapolis or West Point, et cetera. And because we had a cousin in the jewelry industry who had a jewelry store, I used to, as a little kid, sometimes go in with my dad and see them kind of buying and selling diamonds in the back and opening up these little envelopes with diamonds inside. And mm-hmm. the industry, as people on the inside know, has its own lexicon, its own vernacular that sounded all really mysterious and James Bond-like to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I always am someone that's very aesthetic-minded. I'm beauty, architecture, art.
Mm-hmm.
So diamonds and jewelry, kind of art that you can touch and feel, that's tactile, appealed to me from a really young age. So I decided to study to become a gemologist. And so I remember when everybody was putting down colleges at Xavier, which is this really good New York high school, they're like, what? Gemological Institute of American. You know, it's like they're completely befuddled. So
right.
I did. I studied to become a gemologist when I was 17 years old.
Wow. Is that a four-year program?
No, it's actually it's a two-year program that's condensed and intense into a six-month kind of Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, really intense program that if it was in a regular kind of college format would be much longer. So it's intense and it teaches you not only diamonds but gemstones of all sort, tons of stones that you'd never hear of that have nothing to do with jewelry really. And then after that, I begged my way into an apprenticeship as a diamond cutter.
Wow.
And that's how I started on kind of New York's legendary diamond district in 47th Street, which especially back then, this is 1987, 88, it was a microcosm, you know, in and of itself, a whole different culture of that industry. You know, deals were done in the middle of the street on a handshake. Just this whole culture that was very much appealing to me.
Right. So as a cutter, what did you learn? Like, what were they teaching you?
I was a terrible cutter, so I didn't learn much. It's funny because the company, who, by the way, they're still in business. I eventually became a partner in that company. As a cutter, you start with what they call bort, which is like industrial diamond, so you can't really make a mistake, or if you do make a mistake, it doesn't mean anything.
Got it.
And so they teach you how to start to put angles on the stone. Diamond cutting is done on a large wheel that spins, and then you have an arm, and there's diamond dust with oil on the wheel, and the friction, only diamond can cut diamond, as everybody knows.
Uh-huh.
So the diamond dust starts to wear down that rough diamond, and based on how you want to make the stone, round diamond, marquise diamond, etc., you start to work on that wheel.
So as a gemologist, as you're studying in school, are they teaching you about cutting? Or what are you starting to learn that these stone, where they come from, what they look like? Because what we see in a box or on our finger is obviously not what you're starting with.
Correct. Now, gemology doesn't teach you about cutting. It teaches you about the type of stone, the properties of every stone, if a diamond or a colored stone in particular is treated or heated. To look at an emerald and look at the inclusions and know that it's from Colombia or it's from Africa. To look at a ruby and know if it's from Burma or if it's treated or heated or synthetic. And that's really the kind of roll up your sleeves and the nitty gritty of gemology. And then, of course, diamond grading, you know, color, clarity, cut, all of the stuff that people know.
Okay, so then after that, because I know you've done a couple other things. So
yeah.
So after you're doing the cutting and you realize you're not very good, what happens? What do you do?
So the owners of the company saw something in me. I think I had a better head even back then for business than I did for cutting, and I eventually became a partner in that company. The company since then has morphed into a really powerful player in what we call the fancy diamond curler industry, so pink diamonds, blue diamonds, yellow diamonds, that's what they specialize in.
Got it.
But I became a partner. I was there for a couple of years, and then in the late 90s, I had an idea to create a brand, myself and my co-founders at the time, on the buy side of the jewelry industry. So what that meant is that everybody knows the big brands when they want to buy something, be it the fancy brands like Cartier, Tiffany, et cetera. But when people want to sell diamonds or jewelry, it's an asset class. Mm. And there was never before the company I formed a place to go where people who were selling because they had an item and maybe didn't want it any longer,
right.
Maybe they were trading up to something bigger, maybe there was divorce or death or inheritance,
sure.
Where do I go where I'm going to be treated really fairly, get a great price, et cetera? And that didn't exist. You had pawn shops on one end,
right.
You had the auction houses on the other, which could be intimidating, expensive, et cetera, also very selective in what they wanted. So I founded a company in 2001 with my co-founders called Circa, C-I-R-C-A.
Mm-hmm.
And over a 10-plus year period, we became the largest buyers of diamonds and jewelry from the public in the world. We had offices all over the United States, open throughout Europe and Hong Kong. And then in early 2011, I believe I sold to private equity. And so that was, so from being a gemologist and a diamond cutter as a teenager, when I left the diamond cutting business, everybody said, you're completely insane.
Yeah.
That came from, you know, fairly humble circumstances,
mm-hmm.
And said, you've gotten into the industry. But I said, well, I see an opportunity in the industry.
Right.
People aren't being treated correctly when they sell a piece of jewelry or a diamond. They didn't have a place to go that were really invested in making sure they were taken care of and given the right price. And so that was really the revolution of Circa back then. And also it was highly stigmatized back then.
Right.
People selling jewelry, it was like, oh, you're selling, you need the money. And that I knew from being inside the industry is not the case. People had things, just like if you have art or anything else that you want to sell because you're not using it, it's not that you need the money. So you want to be treated.
So I want to talk about that secondary market for a second, because when you think mm-hmm. about, or me as someone who's not in the business, you think about art and reselling it, it doesn't seem like that's a secondary thing. It seems like that's an asset that you have and you're making money and somebody else can have that asset. In luxury, in diamonds or watches or whatever we're talking about in luxury, it almost seems like the value, and cars or whatever, right?
Yeah.
It seems like you drive off the lot and that car goes way down,
right.
Even if you've bought a car for $800,000,
right.
A super luxurious type of car.
Right.
So in diamonds, how does that secondary market work where you still see the value in it and it doesn't go all the way down? Because I know for the layperson, when
right.
they're trying to sell their engagement ring when it doesn't work out or whatever
right.
it is,
right.
they're getting like nothing for it.
Right.
And then there's a whole conversation about lab grown
mm-hmm.
in that as well. But talk about that secondary market.
Sure. So when Circa was at its height and we were buying a huge amount of diamonds and jewelry every single month, you know, you would get people that would come in, and we always used to say kind of the formula of an expectation when someone was selling something was, I have an appraisal for $100,000, I'd like to get about 30% of it. That was kind of like the private person's expectation on
yeah.
average.
Okay.
The answer to your question really is it depends when they bought it and where they bought it, right? So, and also what the item is, right? Because there are items like a large GIA certified diamond that has almost a quasi commodity type value to it.
Mm-hmm.
And there are items like colored stones where the profit margin for the retail jeweler is much larger because you can't comparison shop like you can with a diamond.
Right.
Right. So the more something is like a commodity, like a diamond, the narrower is the profit margin.
Okay.
So if somebody bought a 4-carat round diamond in 1970 and was coming to us in, you know, 2005, very often they got more than they paid for it. And sometimes they would even say, oh, wow, I paid $20,000. I'm getting $25,000 today. I thought it would have gone up so much more. And I said, it has, but here's what you're not realizing. When you bought it for $20,000 in 1970, if you went to go sell it the next day, you would have gotten maybe $4,000 or $5,000.
Mm.
So it's gone up from the $4,000 or $5,000 that you would have gotten the day you bought it
right.
to the $25,000. But now the good news is, what other luxury item holds value?
Mm-hmm.
Really, except like a needle in the haystack car, like you said, a classic
yeah.
car. Most luxury items that people buy don't hold value, but they're okay with it.
Right.
Diamonds and jewelry, for some reason, people seem to have a higher expectation. in terms of, oh, why am I not getting all my money back? The fact is, if you're buying a great item, either a certified diamond or a signed piece of jewelry, mm-hmm. and typically I mean jewelry from Cartier or Tiffany or Van Cleef & Arpels or Bulgari, and you're holding it over a period of time, it is a store of value. Is it an investment? You shouldn't be buying it as an investment, but it's a store of value.
Right.
And so it depends what you bought, and it depends when you bought it.
So, but what about, let's say, the love bracelet that everybody has from Cartier, right? So
right.
It would seem like, by the way, when we went to buy another one the other day, they're all gone, which
right.
I thought was weird, and you
right.
can't get them.
Right.
But and they've made a new one that's a clasp
correct.
Now.
Yeah.
So, but my question is, if there's a surplus and everyone has them,
right.
how are they holding their value?
Well, it's not really a surplus. Well, first of all, things like the love bracelet, the Alhambra, even everybody knows today, especially guys know who like watches, try to buy a Rolex Daytona in a store. First of all, they say, we're not even selling it to you. You wait 2 or 3 years. So
yeah.
there's this supply-demand imbalance that the luxury brands are all using. I'm not saying it's a marketing strategy because there are tremendous demand for some of these items like the love bangle.
Right.
So they hold value in the secondary market. If you had to buy a certain stainless steel Rolex today, you're going to pay more in the secondary market than retail because you can't get it at retail.
Right.
Same thing with many other watches. Same thing with lots of jewelry.
Right. Okay, but let's talk about the emotional component to it. Like, people don't want to think that they've had gotten something used, right? They want
right.
to say, it's brand new, I bought it, or my husband bought it, or whatever. Like, do you feel like emotion has a lot to do with buying?
I think jewelry is a very personal purchase. The fact of the matter, if you were to ask me what holds its value more than anything else, it's going to be vintage signed jewelry, in terms of jewelry. I'm talking about diamonds for a minute. So,
when you say signed, what do you mean by that?
Anything made by one of the great houses, Van Cleef & Arpels, Cartier, Tiffany, Harry Winston, Graff. When you look at Sotheby's and Christie's, the magnificent jewelry sales, and items from anywhere from the 1920s up to the 1980s, 90s, and if you were to look at prices, they just continue to rise year over year. So if you're buying, first of all, when you're buying vintage, in many cases you're buying craftsmanship that just isn't replicated today.
Got it.
You're buying very often the best of the best, because what kind of filters through and gets the auction are the pieces that are iconic. So Cartier Panther jewelry, Van Cleef & Arpels mystery set. These are kind of the best of what every house did that really survived and that really brings a huge price and that the auction houses want. So it's like saying of every car that was ever sold, I'm buying only the certain year Ferrari that I know today is a classic, right? So those things continue to go up in price. So if anybody were looking just at value, you should buy what you love in jewelry, first of all, most important. But if you're looking just at value, if you're buying vintage, because again, you take away the sticker shock of retail. You're not paying the labor when you buy vintage and all that stuff that was paid for already and signed jewelry, because the supply-demand imbalance, collectors and the luxury buyers want things from the major brands.
How do people, when they're trying to buy vintage, how do they know that they're really getting something? Because there's so many knockoffs.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you know who to trust?
It's like anything else. Do your research. The auction houses are a great place to start.
Right.
But there are great jewelers out there, great dealers that will work with the public. But it's like anything else. If I'm looking for a vintage car myself, you ask your friends and people that you trust and know, and you go by reputation.
And you guys, well, you're not a jeweler, but do jewelers know what to spot on certain things so they know that it's real?
Not all, because they're, you know, most modern jewelers today, they're not well-versed in vintage. Some are. Some have, you know, from my last company at Circa, we used to work with retailers all over the country as well. And some modern jewelers have had vintage departments in their store for many years, and they've become really well-versed.
Right.
But some jewelers that are just selling engagement rings all day or watches, they have maybe a very limited knowledge of vintage.
What's your opinion on 47th Street right now? Because I know that I can walk in there and they'll say, don't go to Cartier and buy the love bracelet. I can make you the exact same one. Or don't go buy this vintage piece of Panther or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We can do the same thing.
Like, right.
How do you feel about that?
My feeling is, again, it's really personal. So you're going to pay more when you buy something from a major brand. But
right.
at the end of the day, long term, you're going to get much more value out of that if and when you ever want to sell it.
Right. So if it's about right. the resale.
So it's like Hermes bag, an Hermes Birkin bag, or an Hermes Kelly bag. I mean, you can buy fabulous bags that look great, that don't cost $15,000, $20,000,
right.
that you don't have to go through all the headache of trying to get on an Hermes list or even buy it in the resale market.
Right.
That's become such a big thing. but you want the real thing.
Right. Right?
Hermes wouldn't be successful if people didn't want the real thing.
Right.
And that can go into the lab-grown conversation or anything else. It's not about that this doesn't look okay or look comparable or even look very close to identical. It's about when you're buying luxury, most people want the real thing.
Right.
Most people are willing to pay for the real thing.
Right. Well, the people in that market know that how they feel when they're carrying
right.
it.
Right.
And going back to what we were just talking about before, why is a diamond that is the same quality, whatever, on the papers at Graff different than the same diamond you're getting on 47th Street?
No, so that's not. So it's a great question because I would argue that, and again, general decision, if someone's buying signed jewelry, have something made up, better buy signed jewelry.
Okay.
I would make the opposite argument if you have a great jeweler on 47th Street or anywhere else, that if they're selling you a round diamond, 5-carat GVS2, and it's kind of an identical GIA certificate, I may get a lot of blowback from this, but you don't have to pay the additional premium from a brand. If you trust your jeweler, absolutely go with that jeweler, and you're going to get a better value on average because they don't have the same overhead structure, et cetera, of those big brands.
Right.
However, many clients want to say, I have the Tiffany blue box. I bought it from Tiffany. I bought it from Cartier. And they're not wrong. Like, either is not wrong. I keep saying jewelry is, again, I've said it a bunch of times, it's really personal.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't mind that your engagement ring isn't branded, personally, I wouldn't, not for a diamond ring, because it's really the value is in the diamond, then maybe there's not the need for the brand.
Right.
But if you're buying a great piece of jewelry that you're saying, you have to love it, love the brand and what they do design-wise, and say, okay, I'm gonna get some added value of that brand if and when one day I want to sell it.
What do you think is most misunderstood, though, about diamonds in general? Because, again, there's so much argument about what you have to have, big, small, nicer stone, but smaller. You know, what do you think is most misunderstood?
To me, the most important thing is that people don't realize it's the cut of the diamond, right? So at the end of the day, and again, as an ex-cutter, even though a bad one, as an ex-cutter, diamond ultimately reflects light. It's this mirror that reflects light. And so if the symmetry isn't right, if the dimensions aren't right, the way what they call the pavilion, the underside of the stone, it leaks light and the diamond looks dead. You know, you have people that look at some diamonds and say, it always feels like I have to clean it. Like the stone's not cut right or it has a lot of fluorescence, one of the two. So you can buy a deflawless diamond. It doesn't mean the diamond is going to have optimal sparkle and dispersion, et cetera, because it's not cut right.
So it may say on the paper that it's the most beautiful.
Well, it may say that it's deflawless, but if you look at the specifics and cut, it should say excellent polish, symmetry, et cetera.
Okay.
Right. So cut is really important, and that's something that often gets lost in the conversation. And
Got
so
it.
You could have a diamond that may not be a D color, but it's a G or an H or an I color, perfectly fine, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be flawless, but maybe it's an SI1, also perfectly fine, but it's cut beautiful, and it's still a beautiful diamond and a worthwhile diamond. It's not only about the color and clarity.
Okay, you brought up these letters, and you see this a lot, the G, the D, the VV1, 2,
right.
3, whatever.
Right.
Can you break those down and then tell us what they all mean, but tell us what is the sweet spot, really, for diamonds?
Sure. So DEF is technically completely colorless and transparent. Then as you go down the color G, H, I, J, you start to get a little bit of a tinge of color.
Mm.
Color could be yellow, could be slightly brown. And so that's, you go all the way down and then till you get to the point of XYZ and then fancy color, meaning a fancy yellow.
Okay.
And then you start to go into the category of fancy color diamonds, be it yellow, pink, or anything else.
Okay.
Flawless is clarity. The best. And then next is VVS, which is very, very slightly included.
Mm-hmm.
And that's broken down into two categories, VVS1, VS2. Then VS1 and 2, which is very slightly included. Then it goes SI, slightly included, and I1, imperfect. Again, what I would tell you is there are people over the years, the clients that have come in and said, I want a large diamond, and I want a 5-carat stone. And after that, the next thing that's important to me is color, because I don't want it to look very yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And the least thing that's important to me is clarity, because no one's taking a loop and looking at my diamond.
Yeah.
So that's one perspective. I have other clients over the years, friends of mine, that say, I want a D-flawless, and this is what I have to spend. And so what's the biggest D-flawless I can get for this budget? Are any of those people wrong? Not really. If you were to say, well, what's the most commercially viable? Then a white, cleanish stone, you know, could be D to H, D, you know, VS and better, are on average the most commercially viable. And then there are different markets. So The market in the Far East wants usually whiter, cleaner. What they call U.S. stones can go down lower in color, even to SI clarity, and that's more the U.S. consumer, especially not at the really high end, is more tolerant of a little more of an included stone and a little more color. So markets change around the world.
I'm curious about your opinion on the different, is it called cuts, the radiant, the cushion, whatever, right. whatever they all are. Can you explain what they all are and if there's one that really we should be looking at as opposed to others?
Sure. So the classic cuts are the round, the emerald cut, the marquise, the pear shape, the oval. Cuts that have been around a long time but not as long are kind of the radiant and the princess cuts. They're seen as newer cuts. Of course, there's also the heart shape. Historically, round diamonds are what's sold most often, and so they trade at a little bit of a premium. Right now, as we speak, actually fancy shapes are actually a little bit more in demand, especially larger size pear shapes, ovals. Ovals incredibly popular right now.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit of a trend to it. You know, years ago, like especially when we were buying a tremendous amount of jewelry from the public, it seemed like every engagement ring from the 1950s or 1960s was a marquise, you know, like the football shape, or a pear shape. And then as time has gone on, you think everything from the 80s, like most engagement rings are round stones, or some are square cuts, but it's either usually a round or a square cuts. So marquises or pears, especially in, let's say, average sizes, are looked at as a little bit of a throwback. As you get larger, you see more of them.
Got it.
So.
If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door. No insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
What if I told you that the idea that you only get parasites when you travel to some exotic country is flat wrong? Millions of Americans carry parasites right now, often without symptoms. For example, it's estimated that millions in the United States have been exposed to Toxocara, a parasitic worm, yet most never even know it. Parasites do not need a plane ticket. They can enter through tap water, sushi, undercooked foods, or contaminated produce. Some strains live in all stages, eggs, larvae, adults, hidden in your gut, releasing toxins that sabotage your energy and digestion. That's why I'm excited about Parify, Kim Rogers' 30-day full-spectrum parasite cleanse. The kit works by clearing parasites, worms, candida, and heavy metals, targeting parasites in all life stages, supporting gut health, detox pathways, and toxin removal. It's taken orally, daily, for 30 days with precise dosing. I'm actually doing it myself right now. I started with the Lymph Cleanse Then I'm doing the Parify. Want to dive deep? I did a full interview with Kim Rogers, the worm queen herself, where we expose all the myths, understand the facts, and show how to protect your body. Listen to that episode if you haven't already. Meanwhile, go to rogershood.com and use the code Rachel to get 10% off of your order. That's R-A-C-H-E-L for 10% off. Give it a try. Maybe your body's missing link is hiding inside. Let's do this together. Again, it's rogershood.com, R-O-G-E-R-S-H-O-O-D. .com and use the code Rachel for 10% off. If you've ever been through a divorce or you're in one right now, you already know it's not just emotional, it's chaotic. It's paperwork, deadlines, financial disclosures, custody schedules, legal filings, and half the time you don't even know what you're supposed to be tracking until it's too late. That's why I want to tell you about Splitify. It's an AI-powered divorce operating system designed to turn divorce from drama into data while saving you time and money. Splitify helps you organize all of your documents, evidence, custody details, communication, finances, everything into one secure platform. It can even help flag high conflict behavior, track custody schedules, map assets and debts, and generate court-ready files so you're not walking into a legal battle completely unprepared. Whether you're working with an attorney, going through a mediation, or doing it on your own, Splitify helps you stay organized, informed, and strategic because divorce is expensive enough without wasting time and money on confusion. So if you want to protect yourself, protect your kids, and walk into this process with clarity and control, go to mysplitify.com. Use the code Rachel for 50% off your first 3 months. That's mysplitify, mysplitify.com, promo code Rachel. Can you take, maybe this is a dumb question, can you take someone's former marquee cut, whatever, mm-hmm. and change it into a different cut, or it changes the stone completely and it's not?
No, on occasion you can. It does change the stone. You're obviously going to lose a lot of weight. Some stones that aren't cut really well, so you may have a poorly cut, large marquise cut, and you can kind of shape off the top of the stone and make a much more beautiful pear shape. If you don't mind losing the weight, and if you've bought it at a price where it still justifies making that change in the stone and losing the weight. Right. It's done sometimes.
Okay, so now let's get into this whole conversation about lab versus real. First of all, in your opinion, are they both real, or is one fake and one real?
One's synthetic. One's a tech product, right? So, as you know, we manage a fund that we're the largest non-bank lender to the diamond and jewelry industry. So I finance everyone from publicly traded mining companies to some of the largest wholesalers in the world, meaning the companies who supply Cartier, Tiffany, et cetera, to important retail jewelers, et cetera. And the reason I'm able to finance is because there's a liquid global secondary market for diamonds. Diamonds, like gold, are a store of value. There's a reason they're a store of value. There's genuine scarcity.
Right.
There's genuine scarcity. There's genuine demand. There's genuine demand because for tens of thousands of years, human nature is such that if we fall in love, I want to celebrate with something real. If someone's made a lot of money and wants to celebrate their success or show, my wife can walk in with this big necklace, that's real. The same reason why someone will spend $20,000 on a leather bag, mm-hmm. because it signifies to all that lady's friends, this is who I am. This is where I belong, right? Does anyone need a $20,000 habit? No. So unless human nature changes and people say, I don't care about, if it's the real thing or not the real thing, because you can buy identical Hermes bags, you can buy, all that stuff. Unless human nature changes, the demands for diamonds aren't going to change. When we finance a lot of these large wholesalers who, when lab-grown started to become really popular, asked us both to invest in their lab-grown businesses, and also would I finance lab-grown? And my answer was no, because lab-grown is a tech product, mm-hmm. by definition. What's the kind of one of the immediate things you know about a tech product is that over time it becomes cheaper and cheaper to produce. Think about what a flat-screen TV cost when they first came out and what you can get them for today.
Right.
So I knew over time lab-grown would get cheaper and cheaper to produce. We knew over time as the lab-grown market grew, you would have players going from online direct to consumer. All of these things that would create downward pressure on an item that can be made in unlimited supply. So what's happened? When lab-grown first started to get marketed. It was marketed as an alternative, same thing, ESG friendly, complete nonsense, by the way, not ESG friendly.
What does that mean, ESG?
Meaning that it's not necessarily any more environmentally safe than natural. Completely untrue. The natural the diamond industry is one of the most stigmatized, maligned industries in the world. And in the past, there were some good reasons for it, but the diamond industry is so highly regulated today. What most of the major mines do and where they mine in terms of giving back to the local community, schools, hospitals, it's really incredible to see what they do.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. You mean because people were saying it hurt the earth?
Correct.
Correct.
And that lab grown all of a sudden was free from all that, and it's not true for a whole host of technical reasons that it's just not the case. Having said that, you've seen lab grown prices go from what originally was, say, a 30% discount at retail to today. Somebody asked me for a price on a 6-carat lab grown, $125 per carat. You know, maybe a year and a half ago to 2 years ago, that was thousands of dollars per carat, even in the wholesale market. So the point is lab grown okay? Sure. Just like costume jewelry is okay.
Yeah, right.
It has its own market, and it's a big market. I always joke, I say, my wife loses things. I would only get her lab grown studs because I know where a natural diamond stud's going to, one of them's going to disappear.
Yeah.
Would I buy a lab-grown ring for her? No, absolutely not.
Right.
And I know plenty of women and plenty of guys say, I would never give my, you know, you're good enough for the next best thing. You know, kind of, no, that doesn't really fly for a lot of people.
Right.
However, is there a market for it? Absolutely. This, you know, it's fine.
So, but do you think that lab-grown is it Z Gallery or something? Z Jewelers? What's the, like, the fake stuff?
Listen, Swarovski's going to do fabulous with lab-grown.
Okay, Swarovski.
Right? They're going to, because they have a brand, they're going to charge a premium for it. Their cost basis is going to be little, and people are going to say it's a diamond. It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, Gucci sneakers do a collaboration where lab-grown are on your sneakers. LVMH has a brand called Fred, which is a brand that has been really a non-performer for them for a long time. And I had said to a number of people years ago, I said, this would be great for lab-grown. They just made it a lab-grown brand because it really didn't compete in luxury. So it's not like there's not a market for it or it's bad or anything like that. It's not a diamond in terms of the property that it's natural. A lab-grown diamond was made yesterday. A natural diamond is hundreds of millions of years underground. You have to move 1 ton of earth to get a 1-carat natural diamond. There's real scarcity to it. Most people don't realize that.
Okay, wait, let's get into that because I want to understand. We get it in the box, but let's circle back to where it actually came from.
Sure.
So diamonds are found where?
Africa, Canada, Russia, Brazil, Australia.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Not in Kentucky. Yeah. Somewhere.
Actually, in Arkansas, there's a national park in Arkansas that once in a while they find little diamonds in, but it's not.
How are they even knowing that it's down underground?
Geology. Geologists know there's something called kimberlite, which is a type of soil material that is highly indicative that there's what we call a diamond pipe there, a kimberlite pipe, which produces.
But is it like what we see, you know, in Landman, where you have to dig first, you have to find a spot.
Geologists, yeah. And at this point, all those studies have been done that most people know where the diamond bearing, you know, regions are in the world.
Okay, but it's similar to oil that you have to pick a spot, you have to dig, and then you have to search for it underneath. So.
There are areas that are what you call artisanal mines, mm-hmm. where they're light machinery, where literally they can dig almost, not with their hands, but with almost manual equipment. There's what you call alluvial mining. Alluvial mining is mining off riverbeds where, because there's a diamond pipe upstream and kind of the diamonds get washed downstream, so there are alluvial deposits. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of serious open pit mining with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in equipment where they're going really deep down into the earth as well.
And when they're finding it, does it look like a rock? Is it a ton of stuff? Is it little?
Yeah, it looks like, I'll show you some pictures on my phone. Yeah, it looks like almost like broken glass. I mean, rough diamonds can look very different. Diamonds from Zimbabwe often come with this, they're like little pieces of coal, black skin on it. And then there are some diamonds that look most is octahedron, like two pyramids joined at the base and kind of slightly frosted. So they're a lot of different.
And is the goal to find a bunch of little pieces and cut them up into rings? Do they find a huge stone and cut it up? I mean, how does it work?
Most mines have kind of their own properties. So some mines have a propensity to deliver larger sizes. Some mines have propensity to do higher colors. Some mines are really a mix. At the end of the day, size matters with diamonds, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, where the mines get their value. Huge value is when they find something that's rare, either because of size and quality, or sometimes because if it's a fancy color, if they find a pink or a blue diamond, that can be, you know, a large percentage of that mine's volume in dollars.
So is it more rare to find something big, or it's more rare that people are cutting it big because no one can afford that?
You have to find big to be able to cut big.
Got it.
Right. So you to wind up with, say, even a 20 carat emerald cut, that's coming from a stone that's minimum 50, 60 carat in the rough.
Okay.
Unless that rough is perfect, because you're cutting away a lot of that diamond. You usually, with a large stone, there's other satellite stones that have been cut with it. So it could be 100 carat piece of rough, and maybe you've cut a center stone of 25 carat, and then you've cut a 5 carat, a 3 carat, a couple of 2 carats, etc. So the goal always is to find that large, high-quality diamond.
Got it. But explain, though, that when they're finding it, it doesn't look, I mean, it kind of looks dirty, and it's not, it doesn't look like what we see.
Yeah, it doesn't look like what we see. They typically bathe them in acid afterward to get off all the dirt and get to see the real color of the diamond. Some of them have coatings, so it's hard to see what's really in that diamond, or what you call skin,
okay.
The skin to a stone. And so when cutters start to look at how they're going to cut the diamond, they polish what you call windows into the stone. So you can see where the imperfections are, and then the best way to take the diamond to create the large, you want the combination of the largest, cleanest diamond possible, because that's what brings you back the highest value.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about the fancy stones or the other colors. These are real diamonds. Pink, there's a pink diamond. What are the other, yellow diamond?
Yellow, red, green, blue.
And that's different than a sapphire or amethyst. And just explain the difference.
So sapphire and ruby are the same. They're called corundum.
Okay.
So the difference between sapphire and ruby, just our color. And the difference between a blue sapphire and a pink sapphire, again, it's just that color.
Okay.
Emerald is a stone called beryl, B-E-R-Y-L. Diamond is diamond. It's carbon. So if you have a blue diamond, you have a blue diamond because you have traces of boron in the stone.
Got it. So it's the properties.
It's the properties. That diamond. It's still carbon. Just has a trace element of something else in that stone that gives it this color that makes them unbelievably rare.
Wow.
So of the fancy color diamonds, yellows are the most common, although rare, especially the intense yellows and the vivid yellows. Pinks and blues, incredibly rare. Reds, even more so, and greens, incredibly rare as well. Orange also.
Oh, wow. I've never seen an orange.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I've seen a push more that people are getting these as engagement rings.
Yeah, too. Absolutely. Didn't J-Lo have a pink or something back in the day?
For a while.
Yes. Yeah. Can't keep up.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go back to what you were talking about before about what you do now. Why are banks... why did banks decide not to back these companies?
Sure. So after the financial crisis, the banks really relooked at how they treat credit. There was actually even some legislation called the Basel Accords. And most people are familiar with the finance industry, kind of one of the fastest growing industries over the last 15 plus years is what we call private credit, meaning credit provided by funds and alternative lenders in industries that banks used to participate in. So the diamond industry, through no fault of its own, it's not something that's indicative just to this industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's just post-2008-9 financial crisis, banks retreated from so many different industries. And I recognized early on that the diamond industry was one industry that was going to be really affected. And so I had the idea of creating a fund with my unique knowledge of understanding the underlying asset class and the value of that asset class, that we would be able to lend in a way that was safe, because we actually take physical possession of pieces of inventory, collateral, that keep us safe as a lender. Most of these companies are using the money to buy new inventory, and so we're basically holding bits of collateral at 60, 70 cents on the liquidation value, but we're able to give them capital that they need. And it works for these guys because most big diamond wholesalers have huge inventories, $200, $300 million inventories.
Yeah.
And so we're able to play to their strengths and understanding the values of that inventory and be able to unlock capital for them.
So you're not worried that in the future the inventory isn't going to be able to move because people are wising up to the fact, well, I can get something that's cheaper and then put money into something else like real estate or whatever. I mean, are you worried about that in the future?
No, at the end of the day, the luxury market is growing. The diamond industry, believe it or not, as old a business as it is still growing. You've got markets like India that are driving growth. The U.S., I think, is still growing like 1% or 2% a year.
Okay.
2025, it just came out that the average sale price for diamonds has gone up for the first time in a long time. So you've had a lot of talk about lab-grown, etc. But people miss out that luxury has been strong, and there's more people with a lot of money than any time else in the history of the world.
Okay.
And all those people want brands. They want, you know, natural diamonds. And so we don't have a worry. First of all, when we finance short term. So we're in a contract for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
We're not holding one asset for 2 years or 3 years.
Got it.
Diamonds as an asset class for the last 50 years have enjoyed something like U.S. dollar level volatility. So really stable asset class, very liquid. Most people don't realize that. Instead, when they think about diamonds, they think of blood diamonds and lab grown.
Sure.
And yet when you really kind of roll your sleeves up and ask the questions, it's a unique asset class for a lender.
Okay. So, but I'm sure you've seen it if you've looked on Instagram. I mean, you have kids. I'm not assuming that you're scrolling Instagram.
Yeah.
But, you know, even people like Bethany Frankel, let's say, who has the money to buy, is saying, oh, I'm getting rid of everything nice that I have. It doesn't matter to me anymore. You know, I would rather have the Walmart Birkin, whatever they call it now, and, you know, the lab grown, because that's just what I want now. And then people follow that. They think, well, why am I going to work so hard to pay for that? So I think that's, you know, but now as you're talking, I'm realizing that's just a different audience, though. Because I think the people that are buying luxury do not care about that.
So one of the big misconceptions is that young people aren't buying luxury. And if you look at LVMH's data, 55% of their sales are coming from Gen Z. So for every Bethany Frankel, or let's say for every woman at a certain stage of their life, there are 20 young women that have never had. It's nice to say I'm getting rid of everything, and I'm not talking about Bethany, saying
in
general, right?
Yeah.
It's nice to say I'm getting rid of everything when I've had the last 20, 30 years enjoying all the best of luxury.
Right.
But for every one of those types of people, there's a horde of, of young ladies that would love to have a big diamond, would love to have an Hermes bag, 100%. And want to live that life for a long time, and they'd love to get to the place where they're sick and tired of luxury.
Exactly.
Right?
That is very true.
You know,
it's interesting, though, to see, like, you know, you hear people going to St. Bart's, let's say, for New Year's or Christmas, and it is the young kids.
I don't want to leave the house anymore.
Right.
I don't want to go on vacation.
Right.
Stay home.
I know. But it's like they're the ones, and I don't know if they're taking their parents' credit card,
right,
or Gen Z is just making a lot more money than what we used to make, you know, way back when.
Yeah.
But there is, you know, there's a lot of talk about how people are holding onto their money. But when you actually look at it, there's a lot of people spending a lot of money. And when I used to, for many years, I worked in Vegas,
right,
and I dealt with bottle service. I was the director of VIP operations,
right,
and I dealt with the high rollers. And then I dealt with cultivating a customer. And when I first started, people were, you know, maybe we were getting $2,500 for bottle service at a table. When I left, my biggest customer was spending $500,000 in one sitting.
Think about that.
Just to show off.
Just for an experience that's gone.
Gone. And it doesn't
right.
happen anymore.
Right.
But it was a time when that's when that was what you did.
Right.
So it seems really interesting.
Well, nightlife is, we're going to a whole other subject.
Yeah.
But nightlife has changed, right? For when I was going out, I talk about this all the time. Like, young people aren't drinking the way we used to drink. They're not going out. They're much more health conscious. A lot of the new apps of meeting people are around health and fitness.
That's right.
Which is a great thing. That's fine. I'm happy I grew up and did it when I did it.
Right.
But that's all well and good.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, but you look at social media, so much of it is about this brand and that brand and showing off and showing a car or showing, I mean, social media has driven aspiration on steroids, because how else can you reach, like, you know, say, hey, look at the bag I got, and reach thousands of people.
Yeah.
So social media has driven a tremendous amount of it. So if anything, I mean, luxury is more at the forefront of, let's say, the person who can't afford luxury today than ever before.
Got it.
Right.
So, I mean, you're a guy who's been around. You obviously are very chic. You have a chic wife. What are you guys into? Like, what do you see as luxury?
Well, for me personally, luxury is peace. and time with my family, my wife and kids, and my friends, my loved ones. That's the ultimate luxury, right? Because the one thing we all can be guaranteed is we all don't have an infinite amount of time.
Mm.
And we all take it for granted, especially living in America, and it's an amazing country that, you know, we have so much more than so many others, so you take things for granted.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the ultimate luxury is peace, and that's what luxury, in a sense, should buy. I work hard my whole life, 7 days a week from, you know, very young age, in order to kind of have freedom to be with my family and have someone say, hey, you can't not spend that day with your kids,
right,
or your wife. So to me, it's peace of mind is the ultimate luxury. Of course, we love travel. We're foodies. We love great food. My kids try to bring them up appreciating, you know, things that from things that don't cost anything to, you know, a beautiful place. So
right. Okay. I love that answer, actually. Do you think, let's see, what other questions I want to ask you. Well, what still excites you? What are you looking forward in this industry?
Beauty always excites me.
Okay.
Rarity and beauty. Always, and beauty in anything excites me. I've always been that way. And so when I come across a special diamond, 20 carat blue, or a piece of jewelry, you know, a fabulous old 1940s Van Cleef item, especially when it has certain provenance, that you get to hold that. So, you know, I always made fun of me. My staff always did, because usually always on my desk or in my hand, I always had a large diamond, always. You know, it would switch with a 20-carat stone in my pocket, in my hand, because I just have an affinity to something like that. So I still, to this day, as much as I've done and the different things I've done in my career, I'm most excited when I always joke, playing with pebbles. When I'm looking at a big diamond, be it rough or polished or a fabulous cashmere or sapphire or Burma ruby, and that's still to this day really, really excites me.
What's the most beautiful stone you've ever seen?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I can tell you a story, and it's a special stone. I got a call to go to Geneva, a really important family, aristocratic family that was selling an important diamond. And I spent 2 days with these people, and we ultimately, in Geneva, below ground in the bank, and then Four Seasons, and, you know, kind of negotiating price and all of that. And I got really friendly with the family, and we agreed upon a price, and we were to meet the next morning, kind of help conclude the deal. And the next day when I came down, I saw something was wrong right away. I said, is everything okay? I said, no, we called our family back where they were from, and they said, you know, we moved too quick, and we needed to get one more offer. And they had somebody coming, and they said, the gentleman's here, and he's just going to make an offer. And there's a gentleman from the Middle East in the whole, you know. Mm-hmm. And I said, listen, I understand that it's fine, but we're going to do one thing. We're going to put a number on a piece of paper, and we're going to end it, whoever has, you know, the higher number. And so we went to the bar, and this gentleman, kind of like out of a movie, and I put a number, and I won the stone.
Okay.
So it was over a 50-carat cushion cut. And I remember finally when the stone came back to the States, my daughter Alessandra was, I don't know, 4 or 5 at the time. Mm-hmm. And I remember putting the stone in her hand and saying, don't ever get married unless somebody gives you. And of course, my wife yelled at me, you're spoiling
right,
them.
Right,
they know
right,
you're
right.
going to ruin them for anyone else. Oh, so I'd say that's my favorite stone, but because of my daughter.
Oh, I love that story. Wait a minute. So what did the other guy offer?
I didn't know the price.
Oh.
Yeah, but my price obviously was a little bit higher.
Wow. Yeah. Okay, I love that. And what happened to the stone?
Sold it.
You did?
Yeah, of
okay.
course, yeah.
Sold Interesting. For a good profit?
For a profit, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I love that. All right, and what do you see in the future in terms of the luxury market and the diamond market? Are you, like, predict 5, 10, 15 years from now what we're going to be seeing?
So I think the diamond market in general really hurt itself by rushing for profit and lab-grown, by promoting it. And I mean the retailers and the wholesalers. And I've been outspoken about this in the industry, as have some other really prominent people in the industry, saying, you sold this item just like diamonds when it's not just like diamonds. Mm-hmm. It can be made in unlimited supply, which means there's no resale value. You can guarantee people buying a lab-grown 2 or 3 years ago for $5,000, $6,000, $8,000. And I know this from my former company, where all we did is buy back from the public. When they go to sell that, they're going to have zero value as opposed to some value. So I think the public was, in a sense, slightly misled. Not everybody really understood. Now, maybe some sold it properly and said, hey, this is probably not going to have the same value as if you buy a natural, and some consumers are fine with that. So I think the industry has to get back on track and really market natural diamonds for what it is. And not have this confusion and say natural is special, natural is rare, natural is a store of value. lab-grown is a legitimate alternative for a different use, a different consumer, or sometimes the same consumer, just like me, if I say, hey, I don't want to spend on a natural pair of studs just for this reason.
Mm.
And that's fine. People have a tendency to want to say, this is good, this is bad. It's not really the case. They're just different. Natural will always be there. It's not going anywhere. I think it's leaning into luxury. You're seeing the luxury market expand. So I see, you know, from places like the Middle East, from places like India, Russia, unfortunately, before the war in Ukraine, was a huge market for luxury, and I ostensibly will come back at some point.
Right.
China's still soft right now. People thought the Chinese market would come right back after COVID. It really hasn't fully, but at some point it likely will. So I think, you know, you look at someone like Bernard Arnault and LVMH, you know, he's incredibly brilliant. So much respect for him. I mean, I don't think not many people are betting against him and how he's grown luxury and what the next generation of consumers are for it. So
you used the word scarcity a couple times. I'm curious,
yeah.
First of all, how long does it take to make a diamond?
Well, it's hundreds of millions of years underground.
Okay, so yeah. Is there a chance at some point we will not find any?
Yeah, absolutely. So I may not have these numbers right, but I don't think they'll be far off. Mm-hmm. So I think if we don't find any new diamond mines as they exist now, I think by 2050 we will not have an active diamond mine operating in the world. Now, will we find? We probably think so. You know, it'll happen. But there will become a point where there'll be no more natural diamonds, and you're only going to have what's being recycled.
Wow.
Unless we find others, right?
So. Right, right. So there's a possibility in the year 3000 that
there's no operating diamond mines.
Right. So then it's just what's in consumption, whatever, what everybody has. And maybe that would have been the time that lab-grown could have really made their mark.
Maybe. But at that point, it's not like, why are diamonds so special? I mean, they're very special just because of the properties that they have. The hardest substance, the way they conduct electricity. I mean, there's a million things that are really special about diamond as a substance that make them valuable for the space industry, and industrial uses, et cetera.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, why, you know, from thousands of years ago, I mean, I had Pliny the Elder, who was one of the ancients, and he has a quote about the value of diamonds. You're talking about from ancient times, people recognized diamonds as this rare item that has incredible value, that's attractive to humans. That's not going to change in time.
One thing, and it struck me when you were talking before about lab-grown, and I just want to bring it up. You were talking about how it's $125 a carat or whatever you said.
Yeah, wholesale.
Wholesale, right. That. Okay, so when I had Moshe here, he was talking about how somebody had come in and said that they had bought a 10-carat ring or something, and they were their fiance had paid $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
Can you speak on that, though, about that? If someone is
for a lab-grown.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody's being quoted, because it seems like that is happening a lot. So if they're being quoted a number like that, they're just getting plain ripped off, correct?
To be fair, prices have collapsed, especially over the past year wholesale with lab-grown, right?
Okay.
So, you know, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, the prices were a lot higher, but it was obvious that it was going to happen with the product. Like I said, that's a tech product, could be made in unlimited supply.
Yeah.
And there's more and more of it on the market and more sellers going direct to consumer. So yeah, a lot of people bought lab grown for thousands and thousands of dollars and you have no value.
Mm.
Now maybe that 10 carat stone for $50,000, if you bought the comparable and natural, it would have been $250 or $350.
Yeah.
But you could sell it for good money at some point as well.
Right, right.
You know, and again, it's personal. I would never spend $50,000 on something that is worth zero on a lab-grown diamond.
Right. And then just to go back with resale, on a natural, real diamond,
mm-hmm.
you're getting resale, and sometimes you can even do well.
Yeah, depending on how long you're holding it. But there's always, if you're buying, let's say, you know, a 2.5-carat GVS diamond, and it also depends on where you buy it.
Yeah.
You're buying it really well at a family jeweler or a guy on 47th Street that's treating you well. There's real value there. If, say, God forbid it didn't work out in 3 years or 5 years, you're going to get, I don't know, 25, 35, depending, maybe 45% of your money back.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
But for people that are listening, like, they shouldn't go on Blue Nile or something, you know, those websites, and just sell their jewelry.
I don't
know
if Blue Nile buys, but if you want to buy on Blue Nile, I wouldn't disparage Blue Nile.
No,
it's a real model. It's, you know, it's a real business model for people that want to go on and buy and not interact necessarily. I want service. I want to look at. To me, every diamond is different. Every diamond has a face. I've seen women especially really connect with the diamond and say, this is my diamond.
Yeah.
And I think that's lost with something like Blue Nile, but it's fine.
Yeah.
But I just think if, you know, especially it's an experience. It's an intimate, you know, nice experience to shop for a diamond and find something that you love.
Yeah. You started out on 47th Street. What do you think of what it's become these days? Is it have the same value? All these guys down there are selling you a lot when you walk down that street.
Yeah, I know. It's changed a lot. I mean, I started on that street in 1987. And there was a lot of the real great old timers, Eastern Europeans, a lot of families that fled World War II. And the character and the trust, it felt much more like a community.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually what I would say. The biggest change is it felt much more like a real community. And deals were done, and they're still done on a handshake. But back then, you'd see transactions on the street and deals done on a handshake, and most people knew each other for generations. And today, it's a little bit of a newer generation. I'd say because of the success of the Swiss watch market, there's a lot more watch dealers there. But the real industry, the diamond industry, is not on 47th Street. It's in the buildings upstairs between 45th Street and Rockefeller Center. That's the infrastructure of the U.S. diamond industry is upstairs in those few blocks.
Got it. All right, so what's next for you? Like, what's your big plan?
I love what I do. I'm lucky. We're fortunate in that the diamond industry continues to need funding, so we're growing. So we continue to, you know, to work, to grow our fund, to continue to finance some of the best companies in the world in diamonds and jewelry.
I've seen in your past, though, you've done a bunch of things. I'm just curious
if you have
something in the future that you're like, oh, I really want to do this.
The curse.
Or do you really want to retire?
No, I could never retire.
Okay.
My curse is I'm stressed when I'm not doing something.
Yeah, me too.
And that's not good, right? That's bad.
You always have to have a project.
Yeah, so I always have so many ideas and things to do. And I do a lot of mentoring today within the industry and a lot of mentoring and branding. Because what I did at Cirque was really create a brand. Done it for a lot of other people as well. So I like that and do more of that and helping people. But I spend all of my time kind of managing and building the businesses that I have today.
Got it. So you don't have some interest outside of this narrow focus of gems and...
I do. There are things that intrigue me, but nothing that I'm kind of publicly... Yeah,
got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, yeah.
And then can I ask you, because you brought it up earlier, you talked about being in the polo business.
Yeah,
How did that happen?
I played polo for years and years. I was one of the original members in Palm Beach, the International Polo Club in Wellington.
Like, as a hobby you started this?
Yeah, I started it as a hobby and it became a huge part of my life. I had the polo team that played in Argentina and Palm Beach and the Hamptons, and I played for many years, but it's a dangerous sport. I've broken every bone and et cetera. So after a period of time, I call it quits. Yeah.
Do you go and watch it? When
I can't. I'm not a good spectator. I can only participate.
Got it. Because you get upset about what they're doing wrong or what?
I need to be doing
it. I can't watch it because I get upset for the horses. I always get nervous that they're going to get hit with the stick.
So that a lot of people think that, but actually the best polo ponies are the horses that love it. They wouldn't do it. Horses they wouldn't do it if they didn't love it.
Like, really? Yeah, you think the horses have fun? They see it as a game.
They do. If you're on a great polo pony and if you're not a good rider and the ball moves direction really quickly and you're not in your saddle, that horse is going to move before you even do anything and it goes this way and you're going to fly that way.
Got it.
Yeah. So the
horses knows.
The horses. Yeah.
Up.
Yeah.
Okay, I love that.
Yeah.
All right. Any other things you want to talk about that I haven't covered on the subject at all?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground, Rachel. Thank you.
Well, I really appreciate you being here. I feel like you explained everything very well. And, you know, it's a conversation that people, I feel like, are not educated in.
Yeah.
And they make rash decisions or emotional ones, or sometimes they just pick what's easiest for their budget. And this is helpful because I think that sometimes, even though you have a budget, you should stop and think about what you're purchasing.
That's right.
For, you know, a longer term play.
That's right. And the one thing, and you just brought it up, it's really smart, is there's a lot of misinformation out there. And what people don't realize is that diamonds are a stratified asset class. So what does that mean? It's when gold moves, the whole category moves. When you've heard of these articles recently saying diamond prices have gone down, there's no such thing as diamonds moving in a category. If you're a 1-carat or a 2-carat or 3-carat diamond, what you call a Rappaport diamond price list is published twice a month. That dictates global diamond prices. But every price category, every color and quality, every price, every size category, every color and quality, and every shape, either rounds or fancies, move differently. So diamonds don't move as a group. So what you've seen over the last 3 years when you're hearing all these crazy stories about diamond prices dropping has really been a price drop in the lower size, cheaper quality, because that's where lab-grown has cannibalized. Mm. In the large, high-value stones, there's actually a scarcity, and prices, actually, I was just reading today, are trading at a higher percentage versus Rappaport than they have over the last couple of years. Wow. So it's not true that diamond prices have fallen. No, the category that have been most vulnerable to lab-grown have fallen over the last 36 months, but now they've stabilized. The high end has not fallen at all, and arguably have actually gone up and firmed in price, right? So that's a big misconception that people have, that diamonds move in one category. That's not true.
Amazing. Great information. All right, if our listeners are interested in following you, being mentored by you, anything, where could they find you?
I guess on Instagram, Chris D. Gatto. So D-G-A-T-T-O on Instagram.
Amazing. And a website or anything?
No, Instagram is fine. Okay. Yeah. I mean, the website for the company is the DelgadoFinanceGroup.com.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much for listening to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. Please be sure to subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can support the show by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/misunderstood with Rachel Yucatel. Do you have ideas for the show or want to reach out? Email us at info@misunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's spelled MISS understood. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.